No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of
that was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Last week, we had a Republican who is a respected broadcaster, Maria Sanchez, on the show so that we could get her perspective. And today we're lucky to have with us another distinguished guest, a former candidate for Vice President of the United States for the Constitution Party, Darrell Castle. Mr. Castle is an attorney, a former Marine officer who served our country in Vietnam, and co-founder with his wife of Mia's Children, a foundation which ministers to homeless children in Romania. In addition, Mr. Castle has held several positions with the Constitution Party, including National Vice Chairman. He is also the creator and author of the Castle Report. Before we introduce him, let me say hello to my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, who is joining us from the great state of Arizona. Hi, Kathleen. As always, thanks for helping get the conversation started.
Hi, Senator. Hello, audience. I'm Kathleen Gomez, and welcome to Shadow Politics. Hello, Mr. Castle. We really appreciate you coming on to our show. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We're honored to have you with us so that our listeners can learn more about the Constitution Party, which, as if I remember from doing some of my research, that you used to be called the Taxpayers Party.
Yes.
Was that it? Okay. And you changed your name, I think, in 96. So, you know, I think that I remember hearing of the Taxpayers Party, but maybe you could give us kind of what your principles are of your party, what you're basically about.
Well, we call ourselves the Constitution Party for a reason, and that is that we believe very strongly in the Constitution, that it should be upheld, and that it is what it says it is, the supreme law of the land. And that it is, to a large extent, what separates us from other forms of government. The rule of law, simply that the sovereign is held to the same standard of law as ordinary citizens. The ruler, the king, the president, as we would call him, is not above the law, but is simply subject to the law as we are. That is the rule of law, and we believe very strongly that it should be followed and obeyed. That's the basis of what we believe. And as far as policy today, we're a pro-life party, and we are a party who believes in non-interventionist foreign policy, and so forth.
I see.
Well, before I go any further, I need to thank four brave members of Congress for becoming co-sponsors of the D.C. statehood bill. Congressman Mark Vesey of the 37th District of Texas, Terry Sewell of Alabama's 7th District, Donald Payne of my former home state of New Jersey's 10th, and Joyce Beatty of Ohio's 3rd. Thank you, all of you, for joining the other 55 co-sponsors. This leads me to my first question. Mr. Castle, your bio says that you firmly believe in upholding Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. As you probably know, this is the section of the Constitution that Congress has used to take away the basic rights of the residents of the District of Columbia, because it outlines Congress's powers, one of which is to have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district. Do you believe that Congress should have the right to do this? And if you do believe that, how do you reconcile this with the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights?
Well, I believe the Constitution is what it is. It's pretty easy to understand. I mean, it's plain language, and it clearly makes Congress, gives Congress plenary jurisdiction over the district, and it clearly indicates that Congress intended to control the seat of its government. So, yes, I do believe it.
Well, how does that reconcile with one of your primary principles, which is that freedom, you know, that individuals should have the right to representation? And I mean, don't you believe that every American citizen should be represented in Congress, and they should have the same rights as every other American? I mean, isn't that a principle of your party?
Yes, unless they happen to live in the district.
Well, what makes the district that special example? This is a very important issue to us, of course.
Well, obviously it is, and that's what the Constitution says. I mean, you know that the Constitution is not on your side, and history is not on your side. And I would submit further that the American people are not on your side. Otherwise, you would submit this to a constitutional amendment.
Well, actually, history may not be on our side, but 80% of the American people polled in a nationwide poll believe that the District of Columbia should have the same rights as everybody else. So the American people are on our side. But and the Constitution actually does not take away our right to representation. It only gives the Congress the right to do whatever it wants with the district, and Congress has taken away our right. So I guess I would argue the point and say that it really isn't the Constitution or the Founding Fathers that are our foe, but actually a partisan Congress.
I would suggest to you that if that is what you believe, that you should submit this process and see if you can get 2/3 of both houses of Congress to agree with you, and if you can, then you could submit it to the states for an amendment and see if 3/4 of them will approve it. You're not without a remedy. That is clearly your remedy.
Well, we certainly have other remedies. We have a bill in Congress right now in both houses of Congress that would make us a state. And if we become a state, of course, we would be equal to all other states. So that's an easier remedy for us, and that's the remedy we're pursuing. But I think it's pretty clear how you feel about it. So let's move on to another question. Kathleen?
Okay. Yes, and out to this audience, and I'm sure there are going to be people out there who would like to call in with their opinions. Don't forget that you can call us at 888-429-5471, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 2. You know, I was looking at your principles and your platform, and there's one that I kind of agree with, and that is that I believe it is, you know, your principle about protecting our borders, about protecting our ability to trade with other countries. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Okay. But you don't believe in getting involved in any kind of foreign policy that would kind of commit us to having a military or being involved in anybody's kind of issues overseas, especially when I looked at what you guys were talking about. The Constitution refers a lot to Europe and the situation that they were in at that time, and that they were always having these wars, and we really didn't want to be involved in them. But at that point in time, you know, we also didn't have an Asia per se, or the whole issue. I mean, of course, the Middle East was where it's at, but at that time, because of technology, it was a whole different era, right? So I'm wondering, don't you feel that the global world has become much closer and much intertwined, and that sometimes to protect our foreign trade or to protect our borders, we may need to get involved in foreign policy?
Well, I have no problem with getting involved in foreign policy. That's slightly misquotes our position. We have no problem with foreign policy. We believe in trade and freedom with all nations that want to be friends with us. We just don't believe in intervening militarily in their affairs, such as the wars that have been spread all over the Middle East and other places. Asia, the Middle East, there's no difference. There's always a reason to go to war. and the threat of war, the threat of total war, the threat of nuclear clouds over American cities that have been brought up, that is always the justification of government. Big government always has total war as a threat to hang over our heads as to why it does what it does. And I would submit to you that to a large extent, the government's wasteful attitude toward war, wasteful in terms of lives and in treasure, is what has left us to a large extent in the economic position that we're in right now. So we're not opposed to interacting with foreign nations. We're just opposed to interacting with them militarily when it is not necessary. And okay. We believe that the Constitution requires Congress to declare war if we're going to war against another nation.
So in other words, there could be a situation where you would feel that it is in the best interest of the United States to get involved in a war with someone who is trying to, you know, whether they wanted to declare war on us or something. There is that situation. I guess I was reading it. When I think of the Constitution back then, 200 years ago, it's very limited in how you can, I guess, define it, or what your impression of it is, or how you interpret it is probably a better word. So in looking at that kind of wording, I was just wondering, where would it be that line that you would cross to commit to a military
involvement?
It's pretty
simple, actually. If the President of the United States feels that another country is an imminent threat to the United States, or has done something to attack the United States, that he can walk into a joint session of Congress and ask for a declaration of war, as Franklin Roosevelt did. But since the declaration of war has become out of fashion, it's a funny thing. We've been almost constantly at war since we decided we weren't going to do that anymore. We freed up this unitary executive that we have now to make war all over the world anytime he wants, anywhere he wants. You know, he goes about his business doing that. So it seems pretty obvious to me that the Constitution never intended, and free people can't simply put that power in one person without any accountability as to what he does.
Well, I would. Well, first, let me say I apologize for not saying this at the beginning of the show, because you were a United States Marine. So thank you for your service, Mr. Castle. That's the first thing I say to any member of the military. We appreciate you standing up for your country. But given that, the War Powers Act, is that not constitutional? Does the president not have a constitutional right to engage us in
the president
foreign conflict?
The president has a right to engage us in the event of an emergency until he has a moment to go in and speak to Congress. The War Powers Act can't. Congress has no authority to circumvent the Constitution by passing some act that gives the president the right to use force. You know, I completely disagree with that entire theory, but nevertheless, at least with the War Powers Act, it gives some pretense to what he's doing. For example, when President Johnson went in and asked for authority to use force because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, that was, as we know now, history bears me out, that was a complete ruse. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident, but still, there's always clever ways for people to make war when they want to. So no, I don't think the president has any legal authority to go to war on his own, except in the emergency defense of America.
Well, let me ask you then another question. And before I ask you this question, let me tell the audience that I am a Christian, and my brother was an instructor at the Air Force Academy. So this caught my attention the other day. You may have read that the Air Force Academy has just made optional the words "so help me God" as part of the cadet oath. Do you agree with this? Do you think that this is in line with the First Amendment's requirement of separation between church and state? I'm sorry, or do you disagree with that? As a constitutional party person, do you think that falls in line with the First Amendment's establishment clause and free exercise clause to allow someone who's, let's say, an atheist and serves in the military to not say the word, so help me God?
If it's completely voluntary and a person has the authority to say it, I certainly have questions for him, but yes, I see the issue.
Yes, and I got to tell you, I think you and I probably agree on this. I think it's a sad, sad day that this has come. You know, I think that we should always, especially when we take on a responsibility like going to war, be ever mindful of a higher power. And you know, I hate to see God removed from everything in America, but I think I agree with you. I think if it's of his free will, and I know military people, and I know you know military people, and my guess is that 99.9% of them will say, so help me God.
Well, let me ask a question, and this is coming as being a woman. Of course, I think I am a woman. Sometimes I know, Michael, you object to.
No, I never said. All I've said is you're a mean woman.
All right, good.
Yeah.
One of the principles your party espouses, Mr. Castle, is individual freedom of conscience and action. But your party also believes that you fight for, you know, every right from birth to death. Does your party get involved in the issue of, you know, ending a pregnancy in a case of, say, rape or incest or a health of a woman?
Well, my party believes my party is pro-life without exception. Let me put it that way. We don't believe that exceptions should be made in those rare instances when something like that happens. I mean, I recognize that they do happen. If a baby is a product of rape and someone has to be executed, we would prefer that it be the rapist.
So would you then, if you got into, you were elected and you were running this country and a woman gets raped, I mean, I feel the same way. You know, I think execute the guy. But would there be, and here you are, maybe it's a young girl, 14, let's just say. Maybe she has not been able to finish her education. You know, that is a huge amount of responsibility. I have two children. I know I couldn't get my master's program raising them because I just not was one of those great achievers. Would your party support helping that young girl finish her education or be able to give her childcare while she goes to school? I mean, you know, I feel very, very deeply that, and I respect your opinion to be pro-life, but I think in that situation where you've gotten involved in that woman's situation, then don't you have a responsibility to help her get back on
her
feet?
We have a responsibility to protect human life. I believe that is our first responsibility. This young woman, as you put it, I'm sure the social safety net would be there for her, as it is for people who, for any young girl who's pregnant right now or anything else. I mean, we're certainly not in favor of jerking that net away from people and saying, hey, you know, you're on your own and good luck. That's not the way this country works right now. I don't see that your example changes that any.
But in your party, you don't believe in a federal social welfare program, correct? So saying that your party is there, and if I understand it, you don't believe in really federal government being involved in this stuff.
My party doesn't believe in social welfare programs per se, but we understand that simply cannot be jerked from people suddenly when we've created generations of dependent people. That's not what we're about.
Go ahead, Michael. I'm just curious on how you would make a society, because I agree with you. I think there is generations that have become dependent. I think there's a lot of issues that are affecting our society, you know, as far as moral issues and, you know, sex and all the stuff we see on TV and we hear. But how do you think you would be able, if you were to win in the next presidential election, do you believe you could somehow have some kind of forum or policy that would be able to change that?
Well, I lost the first part of your
yeah, me too.
Statement.
You did. Okay. But that you don't understand it, or you guys didn't hear me?
I don't think I heard it.
Okay. I guess my question was, when you made that statement that you believe that, you know, you don't want to, we have generations of dependents. If you became the party that won at the next election, do you believe that you would be able to untangle this, and then you would keep certain social platforms in there to help, say, young women who are raped, to help them continue their career or be able to get on their feet and support their children?
All right, I've got it now.
Okay.
I think, first of all, I don't think anybody can untangle the mess that this country is right now. I would very much like to have the opportunity to try. I mean, if Jesus were suddenly elected president, I think he could probably solve our economic problems. But other than that, I just don't see it happening.
Okay.
You know, if we have an economy still going in 2016, and it's God's will that I be raised into that position, then I would defer to that. But do I think it could be done? Yes, but not without a great deal of pain. If you go back to the end of the Reagan administration, when Bush won, came in, we had an opportunity there, an opportunity that we passed on. The defense appropriations that we had spent countless sums of money over decades fighting the Soviet Union that we didn't have to fight anymore, the peace dividend, if you will. So Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, and now Obama, instead of using that peace dividend to shore up the social safety net and to reinstall the money that had been stolen from Social Security trust funds to rebuild infrastructure and to reduce taxes so that the American people could have some of it back. Instead of doing that, we dropped it on primitive people all over the world in the form of bombs and so forth. But that's another situation. The economy is in such a mess right now that, you know, I don't see how it can be reversed. But nevertheless, I think it can be reversed, but not until this country is willing to go through the valley. As the house of cards gets higher and higher, the pile that it makes when it falls is getting bigger and bigger, and sooner or later we're going to have to deal with it. And at some point, later becomes sooner, and I think that's coming right now. And the social safety net is not going to be there for any of us if we don't do something, and very quick.
Well, let me ask you, since you seem to say that you don't want to jerk away the social safety net, what about immigration? What about a pathway to citizenship for undocumented aliens that are in the United States now? How do you feel about that? How does your party feel about
it? I'm opposed to it, and my party's opposed to it. We don't think that it's unreasonable to ask people who want to come to America to come legally according to our laws.
Well, and what do we do with these people? What do we do with people, let's say, that are American citizens? Because, and we see this all the time, their parents are undocumented, but they came here and they were born here. And by the right of their birth, they're American citizens. What do we do with these children? Do we send them back to the, you know, the country of their parents' origins because their parents came in illegally? Or is there a different set of rules for the parents and for the children?
Well, I'm personally not in favor of deporting these people, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
No, I'm not in favor of deporting them, but neither am I in favor of making them citizens. And neither am I in favor of giving them benefits of the social safety net, except in emergency situations that are available to U.S. citizens.
What do we do with them?
Well, let me ask this question because, you know, Mr. Castle, I'm here in the state of Arizona, and I do see the problem that's happened from people who came over. I mean, I grew up on the Mexican border, so across the border was a town, Al Prieto, quite large, and people would come over to the United States to have their children, and then they'd go back and live in, you know, the border town, but their children would have access to all the different programs. So I have seen where people have abused it to the point that it's really kind of bankrupt our hospital in that little town and other services. But then again, I do see, because I am also in that population and raised my grandfather, got amnesty at the turn of the century. He had come over, but there was really no borders at the time. This was in like 1920s or whatever. But I do see young children who grow up and go and serve the military and become so devout Americans. I mean, almost, I think, more patriotic than those who are third or fourth generation Americans. And they love the American flag. They love what America stands for. Yet their parents were undocumented. Would you see something that those kids maybe, or those young adults, I would say, would have a way to citizenship that would not require them to leave the United States and have a process of waiting up to maybe 14 years before they got their citizenship?
Well, number one, everyone has an avenue for citizenship through the naturalization process. I've been to many naturalization ceremonies, and there are hundreds of people who become citizens here in my hometown of Memphis every year through the naturalization process, so that's always open. All they have to really do is comply with the law, but, you know, there are exceptions made in the situations that you describe all the time. But illegal immigration would be less of a problem if we had a constitutional president, because the border would not be open, unguarded, unprotected for anyone with bad intent or good intent or no intent to cross anytime he pleases. Who knows what he might be carrying or what his intent might be. It's a president's duty to protect the borders. He is mandated to do that in the Constitution.
And I agree with you, but I will say, being I was in New York for 20 years, and I just went back to my hometown on the Mexican border, been there about 6 years. And I have seen an incredible, I mean, there's cameras every mile. There's now infrastructure so that it can be patrolled. I mean, you physically cannot patrol that border. It's so big. And from my hometown of Douglas to, say, Columbus, New Mexico, it's just all open country, and it's not fenced in. There's not enough people or border patrol to really be able to do that job. And I'm very much for a secure border, because living on there, I've seen what it's not just illegal immigration, but it's people coming from India and Pakistan and, you know, Russia and Afghanistan who don't, I believe, have the good intent. And I do agree with you. But, you know, 14 years sometimes is what I understand from the friends who have gone through the naturalized process it takes to become a citizen. And, you know, if these children have been in the United States, they're 22 now, they served in the military, and I guess what you're saying, there are exceptions. It's just, I just wonder how we can protect that border without building a huge wall. And, you know, Mexico, for Arizona's economy, it's $13 billion a year in trade. So,
well, let me put it like this. We protect Korea's borders. We protect Germany's borders. We protect Afghanistan's borders. We protect Iraq's borders. We protect Saudi Arabia's borders. Why can't we protect our own? Are you telling me that the 82nd and 101st Airborne Division couldn't protect our border? I would submit that they can. And if we stop spending the trillions of dollars fighting these Stone Age people all over the world for no reason, we could easily protect our borders. You don't have to build a wall like the Israelis built, but you do need some kind of fence, and it has to be manned.
Well, let me ask you a question, Mr. Castle. It seems to me that you have a lot. Your party has a lot to say about the parties that are in power right now. And when I was I'm a Democrat, as you probably know, and in the early mid-1980s, there was a movement inside the Democratic Party called the Democratic Leadership Council, which created an organization to push the Democratic Party more towards the center. We were kind of classic liberals in those days. Dukakis was our candidate. Mondale was our candidate. And so this conservative group got together, or more conservative group of Democrats, Sam Nunn, Al Gore, Bill Clinton got together, and they pushed our party more towards the center. Why a separate party for the Constitution Party? Why don't you work within with conservatives, for example, inside the Republican Party and try to push the Republican Party more in your direction? Why do you feel you need a separate party to do this?
Well, because it's totally corrupt, just like the Democrat Party is. I admired the Democrat liberals of the 60s and 70s much more than I do the Democrats of today. They at least had some standards. And all those kids out there in the streets demonstrating against the war, I didn't understand at the time. I was young and foolish. But I come to understand it in the long term. And that's why I look to them today, these Democrats, I mean, and I wonder why they sign off on all this stuff. Why do they sign off on all these imperialistic wars? Why do they sign off on the National Defense Authorization Act that allows the indefinite defense, the detention of people without charges, the Patriot Act, so on and on and on down the line? Why do they do that? And why do the Republicans do it? Why does it seem that every election, once they're elected, they're all the same? They're all corporatists joining together with a few international corporations to rob and loot America and now the whole world. That's why I can't be a part of one of those parties.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I don't have serious disagreement with you here.
Me either.
I think we've been co-opted, and I think you're right. I was one of those kids that protested the war in Vietnam. I was in the last draft lottery. I love my country. I have great respect for everyone who's ever stood up and defended my freedom. And I agree with you. And it's part of the reason that Kathleen and I started this show is because we're tired of watching our party and others just pander to the American people. And to answer your question on why this has become the case, I think it's because we govern now by polls and we all pander to the same interests. And, you know, we're all, I think you're right. I think we need a set of standards that we can all adhere to, things that, you know, I used to call it being an American. There were things that we all believed in kind of collectively, a group of standards that I think are gone now. I think that, we all believe one way until the poll comes out and shows us that it's more popular to believe another way. And
you know why that is the way it is? Because nothing matters to a politician but power. Power is more addictive than any drug.
Absolutely.
These people live their entire lives lusting for it, dreaming of it. And when they finally get it, they're going to use it against the powerless. That is the way it is. They have no standards. Nothing but power matters to them. And they own everything. They own the media. They own the education systems. They even own the ecclesiastical systems now. So if you ever become convicted of being a member of the party that you're in, we certainly would welcome you in the Constitution Party.
Wow.
Well, let me tell you this. And I
agree with that, by the way. I agree that you know, all money can get you beyond a certain point is power. And when you get power in Washington, it's just like mainline. And, we've seen people, I hate to interrupt you, Kathleen, but Kathleen and I have both worked in politics for many years, and we've seen people that got into it for all the right reasons and got distorted and sucked into the power vortex and have just turned into terrible people.
Well, a person going in to politics, and I've never been elected to anything, but I've been around it for 22 years now, and I know many politicians. A couple of them are even Democrats, but I have noticed that the ones who seem to have good intent, once they're elected, they quickly find out that their real constituency is the leadership of their own party, not the American people.
That's right. True.
Right.
And let me say this before we go for a break. I was a Democrat and worked with Michael, and we worked in at the Democratic conventions and the Democratic Party. But when I came back, and this kind of leads into a question about, you know, why the Constitutional Party, I believe, believes to give a lot in state rights. But I came back to my home state of Arizona, to where I was raised in Cochise County, which I, one time we used to be called the Pinto Democrats because they said we would change our spots because we voted for the person, not the party. Now, when I came back, my father was running for mayor of my small town. I witnessed such a corrupt Democratic Party that's only purpose and would do anything to get enough votes to win. It didn't matter what the issue was. Whatever it took to win was what was the reason we did things. Instead of what was right, it's what we've got to win no matter what we have to do that. So I changed my affiliation and I'm now an independent because I became so brokenhearted and disgusted and just, I mean, I wish I could turn on in all the ones that I know who are so corrupt from violating, you know, voters' rights. And I could just go on. It's one of my soap opera kind of box types of things.
I'm sure God will remember you in heaven for what you did.
Let me say, just to be honest about it, I think you owe a bunch of dues to the Democratic Party, and that's why you're becoming independent. I think they tossed you out, didn't they, Kathleen?
No, I went out on my own. I got very angry, and I went out. And I hate to say it because I have a lot of Democratic friends, but the corruption that I feel the Democratic Party, what it stood for, those standards you're talking about, Mr. Castle, what I saw was happening in my hometown, my county had just become so corrupt. I couldn't find any standards. And that's what finally I had to just leave it because I was so disgusted. So then my question is, you know, I don't know if I understand the part, your party correctly, but you do believe in giving states more rights than the federal governments, which means, you know, putting your hope in your local, like your state, your governor or your city council. Quite frankly, what I saw in my county scared me so much that I would hate to see any more power handed over to them because they would become so corrupt. I wouldn't even know what would happen. How do you feel about that?
Well, Washington money has corrupted everything. And the states, we believe strongly in the 10th Amendment, which gives all power to states and to the people except those specifically delegated in the Constitution. In Article 1 for Congress. But as far as the localities being corrupted, yes, absolutely. Government from top to bottom is very wicked. People have a far greater chance of changing that on a local level. We have almost zero chance of changing it on the national level because now when you're corrupted by Washington, you're really corrupted because now you have power not over just the people of America but over the entire world. Technology and our military advantages given the leaders of our new empire worldwide power and what a drug that must be for them and their money that they print with reckless disregard for what it's doing to the whole world just flows out from them. They buy everyone and everything. Every state governor is scared to death that Washington will say, well, if you do that, we're just going to cut off your money. None of them have the guts to just say, well, you know what? If you cut off our money, we'll cut off your money. We'll sequester the tax money from our state, and we'll dole it out to you as we see fit. How do you like that? None of them have the courage to do that, but if they did, Washington might take a step back occasionally.
Well, you know, I would say about that, Mr. Castle, I agree to a certain extent, and I was trying to be cute with Kathleen. I don't think either party has the moral high ground. But I will say that the example you just gave is perfect for me because we wouldn't have had integration in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia if it hadn't been for the federal government. If we had left it up to the states, we would there'd still be African-American children, I believe, going to segregated schools in Alabama. It took the federal government to step in, and they used the power that you just said. They said, you know what? If you're a college and you don't integrate, we'll cut off your funding. And the colleges said, okay, well, we can't survive without federal funding. We'll go along. So I think that's a power that the federal government has to use, because if we leave it up to the states on certain issues, especially civil rights, that's the one that comes to mind, I don't think they can be trusted to, you know, I think that parochial interests are just as corrupt and that our civil rights won't be safeguarded if we leave it up to the state.
You're certainly right about that. I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about enforcing civil rights laws. I mean, the Constitution pretty clearly entitles everyone to due process and equal protection and so forth. I don't see any conflict there at all.
Hey, listen, we have a caller, Mike. Let's not go to break, because this is interesting.
Yeah, let's take the caller.
It's Ray, I guess, from Arizona. Is he from Arizona? Yeah.
Ray, what would you like to ask?
Last time I checked. Anyhow, hi, Kathleen. Hi, Senator and Mr. Gaskell.
Hey, how are you?
I did 20 years in the Army, and then did Blackwater starting in 93. It goes on, you know, Grenada, all that good stuff. But I disagree with the way you take it about the commander-in-chief, the elected commander-in-chief. People voted for him. You know, it's just like having a commander in the armed forces. If he says jump, you jump. You know, you're a sworn-in soldier. But I don't understand your philosophy on it.
Mr. Castle, you want to take that?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Is he's asking about the president as commander in chief? I think, right?
Right. That he's elected by the people.
If he orders somebody to go, then they have to go. Well, you know, yes, but the Uniform Code of Military Justice doesn't require soldiers to obey unconstitutional and illegal orders, even if given by the president. But aside from that, what I'm saying is not that soldiers and Marines and sailors and airmen out there in the field should disregard and disobey presidential orders. I'm saying those orders should not be given. It's a completely different concept. However, if the president of the United States orders a soldier to murder a completely innocent person, that is an illegal order, and he has no legal obligation to obey it.
Oh, I agree with you. That's an unlawful order. I agree with you 100%. But what I'm saying is, every soldier, before they go into any branch of the service, I understand. And thank you by the way for your service. In the Marines, has to be sworn in, defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we have a commander-in-chief that decides that. Now,
sir, that is completely wrong. The commander-in-chief doesn't decide that. The Constitution gives Congress the right to decide that. There is no one person who is trusted with power to decide who our enemies are. What if he decided that you're an enemy? What if he decided that one day you're an enemy? What then?
Well, I think, you know, if I might interject here, Ray, I think part of what Ray is saying is that you seem to give the impression, Mr. Castle, and maybe we're wrong about this, that Congress is somehow got a superior role, not only in the declaration of war, but also in the priorities set for the military. Is that true? Is that what you believe?
The last part of it about the military I lost. Congress has the only role in the declaration of war constitutionally. What was the last part of your statement?
Well, and so if they have the only role constitutionally, does the president, after the Congress declares war, then it's up to the president to make decisions as the commander-in-chief of what the military does?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
all right, and
you,
I think that may be a little confusing for Ray. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, thank,
and
you,
thank
for
you for your service.
As a soldier, it is confusing. Because I always thought to, you know, to jump whenever the commander-in-chief or my commanders, you know, any commissioned officer said jump. And then, you know, it goes back from my standpoint, there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. You know, most of the presidents that have declared war were Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Well,
well,
thank
let's
you
look
for
back and see, if, is that really true? The presidents who declared wars were Republicans. I want to ask you if that's actually true. Was Franklin Roosevelt a Republican? Was Woodrow Wilson a Republican? Those are the only two in the last century that actually declared war.
Well, actually, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt did what you want, Mr. Castle.
That's exactly right. They did. And you know what? Since we stopped doing that, we haven't won very many.
Yeah.
Well, that's very true.
That's very true.
And this is the kind of conversation that I think that Michael and I are real excited about, because I, you know, in talking to you, instead of just having my perceptions on what I read on the internet or what I research, it's a total different thing in being able to talk to you about what your party stands about. And I think that's what Michael and I want to do in this show, is show people that no matter how far away we may think we are, we really, there's a lot of things that we can agree on. And I just think this is great, because you've really enlightened me in what I thought your party was about, because I thought it was much more stringent. And then listening to you, I see that you know that there's nothing that can be that black and white. There's room to negotiate for someone like me with your party.
You sound like an honorable and decent woman, and you would make a good Constitution Party member. There's something inside of you that's trying to get out, I think.
Well, you know, I think that you're absolutely right about that, Mr. Castle. I've known this woman for more than 30 years in politics, and she is honorable. And I think there's a place inside all of us where we can touch each other. And that's one thing that bothers me in Washington, is that we've become so divided that we put these labels like Constitution Party or Tea Party or whatever label we want to use. And then we shut down. We don't listen to what the other person has to say. We only want to talk and not listen. So, think that you're right.
It's absolutely right, and I hope and pray every day that Americans can sit down at the table of brotherhood, as Martin Luther King said, and judge each other from their character and so forth rather than the color of our skin. But unfortunately, we seem to get further away from that all the time.
Yes,
the media screams out to us every day about our differences.
Yes.
And no one can hear each other because we're all screaming.
Right. And you know what? There was a sad commentary in the Washington Post today. I don't know if you followed the governor. There's only two gubernatorial elections this year, and one of them's in Virginia. And one of them is actually against the guy. One of the candidates is a guy that Kathleen and I worked with for many years. And both candidates have just spent millions and millions and millions of dollars trashing each other. And we haven't seen one commercial from either candidate that talks about what they're going to do. All they talk about is how sleazy the other guy is. And somebody wrote a letter to the Post today and said, isn't that terrible that we have to decide which of the two sleazy candidates is least sleazy? And that's our choice. And how do we promote candidates that, you know, that actually talk about the issues? So what do you think? How do we promote candidates that actually
talk about the issues? Well, that's a good question. Specifically in that Virginia race, I think what's happening there is that both parties recognize the importance of this race nationally and what it indicates for the future. The Clintons certainly do, and many others on the other side certainly do. But how do we promote good parties? You know, there's always a Constitution Party candidate around. It's just that nobody bothers to look at them because they don't have any money. And they don't have any money because they won't sell themselves to the corporate interest. And even if they were willing to do that, which they're not, the corporate interests don't consider them relevant. You know, the corporations want to buy both sides. So they give, they hedge their bets, and as the polls, as you indicated earlier, as the polls move one way or another, they shift more and more of their money to the other person, hoping that they will be backing a winner. But those of us sitting out there on the fringes, we have no money to campaign with, so nobody ever hears about us. So the only candidates that are possible, that can possibly be relevant, are the people that are totally owned by these interests that we talked about. So nothing ever changes except to get worse.
Well, yes, and we certainly feel that. But now that you've gotten on the subject, this is really Kathleen's question, but I'm going to steal it from her. We noticed that there's a Facebook page that's called Draft Daryl Castle for President 2016. Do you plan to run for president, Mr. Castle?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, if that page has got like 63 million hits on it, I'd seriously consider it. But, you know,
let me tell you, after our conversation today, I guarantee you that it will have two more hits on it.
Yes,
I don't know how many
hits
it has now, but you'll have at least two more. And I, you know, what you just explained, just so I can tell you that we're simpatico. What you just explained is my life too. You know, nobody listens to me because, I'm referred to as the shadow senator in the District of Columbia. I don't have any power and I don't have any money. So what I do is, I get on the internet and, I try to get my point across, and I do other things that I can do to get it done. But I understand you. I saw your candidate, Virgil Good, in a debate of, I don't even know what they were calling it last time. You'll probably remember this, like a third party candidate debate or something. And I thought that he did excellent. I thought he was an excellent candidate. I thought he did a great job in that debate. But that's the one and only time I ever heard him or saw him. And I just happened to come across the debate on, I forget who was carrying it. Maybe it was C-SPAN one day, and I watched it, and I thought it was an amazing candidate. And I'm sorry that he didn't get more coverage.
Well, there's some organizations out there. Free and Equal is one of them that, is basically, trying to put together an organization for 2016 where there will be national stage debates for the third parties, because the Democrats and Republicans are never going to let one of us on the same stage with them. But
yes,
these people plan to have a series of debates in LA and in New York where the third party candidates, the Constitution Party, the Greens and the Libertarians, I suppose, would be on the big stage in front of a national audience. So that would be pretty exciting if it came to pass.
Yeah,
that would be great.
And I want to offer Kathleen Gomez up as running mate. If
well,
you need a running mate,
Kathleen
would be a good running mate. And she wouldn't say anything more ridiculous than Joe Biden has said in the past. I guarantee that.
Hey, I'm glad to meet somebody who can see the good in me instead of, you know, you just don't appreciate me, Michael. That's the problem.
Well, he didn't set a very high standard for you there, saying you could you could get a little bit above Joe Biden. That shouldn't be that difficult. But I get to Washington quite a bit. My daughter lives there, and my son-in-law is a student at American University Law School.
Oh,
sometime
right.
When I'm up there, we'll have to go to lunch or something.
You know what? I would love to take you to lunch in the Senate dining room, which is one of the few privileges that the Senate extends to me, and I live by American University. My wife's an alumni, so.
And I'm an alumni of American.
Oh, and Kathleen's an alumni. I forgot.
I saw that on both your bios. That's why I mentioned it.
I forgot you went to college.
That's right. That's how he just doesn't
but,
appreciate
me. No, I'll take you up on that Senate dining room, because that's about
all
the
right.
closest I'll ever get to that room. That's for sure.
Well, you and me both is as close as I'm going to get to the Senate, it looks like, sometimes. Well, we're out of time here with only a minute or two to go. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on. And I want to give you the opportunity, because you've been such a good guest, Mr. Castle. Is there anything you want to plug? Do you want to plug your foundation, your Mia's Children Foundation, and tell people how they can contribute or anything else? We want to give you a minute to say.
Mia's Children is an organization that runs an orphanage for homeless children in Romania. You can find it on the web at Mia's. It's M-I-A-S, no apostrophe, just M-I-A-S-children.com. And there's a way on there that you can contribute money if you see fit to do that. And you can find my stuff, most of it anyway, on castlereport.us.
You know what? And we've listened to a few of your podcasts, and they're great, and I encourage people to do that. Thanks so much for being on. I hope you'll come on again.
Anytime.
Go ahead, Kathleen.
No, I just want to thank you, because this is one of the first shows that I think actually succeeded in what our purpose was when we started it, was to be able to talk a little bit with someone who we feel might have been on the complete opposite side of what we thought was important, only to find out that actually, you know, we think a lot alike. Even Mr. Senator Brown over there had some positive things and could see that, you know, we really do have so much in common than we do that's keeping us apart. So I want to thank you so much for coming on and taking the courage to talk to us, because I don't know how we may look on paper, but sometimes what you look and see on paper doesn't give the soul of what the issue is or who the people are.
Well, now Kathleen's setting the bar low for you by comparing you to me. But again, thank you so much. And I hope you do run for president. And like I say, I can assure you, you'll get two more hits on your website after this. You've just been a great guest, and we appreciate everything you've had to say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on.
Okay.
You're welcome.
All right, America. Thank you for listening. thanks for calling in, Ray, and we'll see you next week. We're going to try to have somebody from the Green Party come on next week and talk to us about how they feel about America. And hopefully in the end, we'll be able to get some people together and come up with some solutions for these problems that nobody seems to be talking about. Because in the end, I believe that all of us, whether you're a Constitution Party person, a Democrat, a Republican, a Green Party people person, you love America. I love America. I know Kathleen loves America. It's obvious that Mr. Castle loves America. So we need to get together and move ourselves forward.
And thanks. One last thing, too, is that Mr. Castle mentioned that these fair and equal, I guess, organizations are trying to do this debates of other candidates. And everyone who listens to the show should go on and see if they can find that organization and support them, because that's sometimes what you need, just a critical mass of people saying, yeah, we want you to do this. This is what our country needs, to hear from some other parties and from some other ideas and other people who care about our country. So please try to do that when you get off this, when you stop listening to our show.
That's a good point, Kathleen. And I will ask our trusty production assistant, Rachel, to look into that this week and see how we can come up with some information to tell people exactly how to do that next week. Okay, America, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, America.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.